Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 45th episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, audiobooks that help us understand the world. On this episode, I was joined by Charles Dunst, author of the book Defeating the Dictators, How Democracy Can Prevail in the Age of the Strong Man. And the book offers a compelling and pragmatic analysis of the authoritarianism versus democracy debate that builds its case by drawing on a wide range of illustrations from around the globe and throughout history. And in the book, Charles clearly lays out the dangers of rising authoritarianism and the steps that must be taken by democracies to rebuild trust, restore accountability, and deliver on their fundamental promise. It was great discussing the book with him, and I hope you enjoy the episode. How and why has, for many people in the West, has it gotten to the point to where an autocratic regime seems more appealing than the democratic one we currently have?
So I think it's basically just that the democratic systems haven't worked as well as they're supposed to across a variety of sectors, a variety of issues. Where I think about in the United States, I mean, life expectancy has now gone down over the last year or 2 years. And that's a really troubling indication to me of a system that's obviously not working. If basically democracies can't even say people are not living longer, even though GDP is growing and all these indicators seem to be fine, but things aren't actually working on the kind of human person-to-person level. And I think what I've heard when I talk to people in London, in New York, in Tennessee, in Malaysia, the comment is always kind of the same, that as much as our countries got richer and as much as trade between, say, the United Kingdom and China made both sets of governments or both sets of economies richer, that wealth didn't trickle down, for lack of a better phrase, where people feel as if globalization hasn't worked for them and people connect to globalization with liberal democracy. And they say, well, you had liberal capitalism, you had liberal democracy. One of those things didn't work for me. And one of those things, being the economy, was shepherded along by liberal politicians, meaning small L, not liberal politicians like Labor or the Democrats, but liberal meaning people who believe in democracy and believe in free trade. So I think the notion is basically just that the systems haven't worked well enough, and whether that's allowing money to seep into politics, whether that's letting the safety net kind of lag, whether that's having kind of short-sighted immigration policies. I think that's the broader issue here, is people are looking at autocracy as something different and something new because they feel like the existing systems have just failed them.
And I'll be honest with you, Charles, I haven't been to Singapore, but the way you described it in the early chapters even had me thinking, why isn't the UK more like this? Is that part of the issue here and tied into why you decided to write this book?
It's definitely an issue, and it's more of an issue, honestly, in the UK than the US, where I think it was a bunch of the Tory politicians have said it's they want to be Singapore on the Thames. They want to kind of transform post-Brexit UK into a Singapore-like country, with their notion being, well, Singapore is low taxes, it's low regulation, so it's a financial hub. That's what London and that's what the United Kingdom should be. And for a variety of reasons, I don't think that makes a ton of sense. But I understand the imperative. The imperative is saying, well, look at this small autocratic country that has no natural resources, that became really rich really fast. And it's a marked contrast compared to when people talk about the United Arab Emirates, or people talk about even Saudi Arabia as well. They got very rich, but they got very rich because they had oil. Where Singapore is kind of this odd exception of, they don't have any natural resources. Their natural resources are their people, are very productive and kind of hardworking people. That's basically been formed by a fairly effective government in terms of education and all that. So it is definitely a concern. Whenever I was recently in the UK doing about 10 days of events related to the book, and I think I asked both Labour and Tory audiences, I said, well, how many of you have been to Singapore or the UAE or Saudi Arabia or somewhere in China like Shenzhen or Shanghai? And, you know, half the room raises their hands. I go, well, how many of you returned home, whether home is Paris or London or New York, and said, well, I felt like those other systems were working better, and everyone raised their hands. And that really is the crux of the problem, is I live in Washington, D.C. I'm born and raised in New York City, and certainly Singapore's infrastructure at this point is certainly better than the New York City subway. The tube has the New York City subway beat, I think, moderately. But even still, it's the same notion of, well, things are old, they don't work as well. And what I want to be very clear about, what I was very clear about in the book, is just because Singapore's infrastructure seems to work does not mean that we should all become autocracies like Singapore. It's precisely the opposite. It's the notion that despite Singapore's benefits as of now, democracies do still perform better across a whole range of items than autocracies do. So, but I do think the kind of authoritarian envy for a Singapore or for a China or for a UAE is really troubling to me, because it indicates that people are saying, well, it feels like our democratic systems are so messy, it feels like they're so complicated, like our politics prevent us from doing anything. Whereas look at Singapore or look at Saudi Arabia or look at China, they just have one guy or a group of three or four up top. We're making all the decisions, and the decisions get made very fast, and infrastructure gets built very fast, systems get reformed very fast. And that can be a benefit and a curse for them, where, sure, you can build infrastructure very fast, but that infrastructure might not be very good in the short term or in the long term, because it's kind of a one-party state with limited checks and balances. But the notion, the vision that China and Saudi and the UAE and Singapore do things so much better than we do, that's a real troubling problem. And I think one of the main reasons why people are looking to autocracies as a kind of better system.
One thing I did enjoy about the book is that you dedicate like each chapter into going into detail about the things that democracies can do to prevail. And I want to talk to you about some of these chapters now as well. So how does a system that lacks merit and meritocracy become one which is more likely to be disillusioned with?
I think the problem is essentially when governments and countries stop recognizing the importance of differing starting points. When you say, well, in the United States or in the United Kingdom, you say, well, you know, our college, our university admissions process is meritocratic. We're not taking people just because their parents went to Oxford or their parents to the LSE. But the problem is that system's not accounting for the differences at the entry level of people's schooling, where if you grew up in a lower income household in the United Kingdom, you're significantly less likely to attend a Russell Group University. And if you do not attend a Russell Group University, your lifelong wages are significantly lower than if you do. And the problem there is basically that, well, you're funneling lower income children into worse schools. And as a result, it should be no surprise that their test scores are not as good, or that their college application essays are not as good. And it's a similar issue in the United States. I mean, one thing I pointed out in the book was I live in Arlington, Virginia, which is right across the river from Washington, D.C. And Arlington, Virginia spends 100% more per student on public funds than does Hampton City, Virginia, which Hampton City is maybe three hours away. And Arlington is kind of a wealthy-ish upper middle class suburb, whereas Hampton City is more lower income. It's largely African-American. And it should be no surprise then that the Arlington's kids are getting into better colleges. And that's the problem. And it's one of the main problems is that system is clearly not one based on merit. That system is clearly based on, well, who has the money up front to get a better education. And that's kind of one item that I think is a real, real problem. And there's some other basic ones that basically come down to patronage and clientelism, where you can think about in the United States, it's more of a problem in the US than the UK or elsewhere in Europe. But we have legacy admissions in terms of if your parent goes to Harvard or if your parent goes to Princeton, you are more likely to get into one of those schools, because it's well understood that, well, you want to satisfy your alumni, so the alumni continue to give money to the school. And the stats in the book, I can't remember it exactly, so I don't want to butcher it, but it is something like you're about 20% more likely to get into Harvard if your parent went to Harvard than if you didn't. And that's a real problem, because it basically sends this message of, well, there are two sets of rules for this game. There are the rules for those who are basically playing by the normal rules of, well, let me study as hard as I can, get the best test scores I can, write the best essay I can, and maybe throw an application, maybe you get in. And then on the other hand, there's, well, my parent went to Harvard, so maybe my test scores are slightly worse, but I have this kind of in that gets me into the education system and at a really high level. And there is something similar that does happen in government. Again, more in the United States, I think, than the United Kingdom, but only marginally. And that's just basically you have kind of ministers or people in the White House. And this is not a Democrat or Republican issue, actually. Administrations have done this for about 60 years, where basically it's, I don't know, if your father is a senior White House staffer, so the children get jobs at lower levels, and the children are rarely explicitly unqualified. They're rarely incompetent. But it's hard to imagine that the best and most talented people to run the U.S. government are simply just the children of those who've already been there. And it's a little bit of a taboo in the U.S. People don't really talk about it because it's kind of an uncomfortable thing to say. But I think it's a really unhelpful notion when you're basically elevating friends and family into high positions. And the Trump administration was worse than like everyone else. And that's part of the reason why it has been discussed, where, of course, naming your children to senior posts or putting your son-in-law in charge of the Middle East peace process was like really absurd because they had no experience. Whereas in the past, you know, Bill Clinton put Hillary Clinton in charge of healthcare, and that was not as unreasonable. She had actual experience, and as first lady, she has an actual job and has a portfolio. But it is kind of a similar, I kind of think a slightly similar issue. But the decline of meritocracy is really problematic to me, because in democratic systems, whether that's US, UK, South Korea, Germany, whatever, they're premised on this notion of equality under the law. And they're premised on this notion that if you work hard, you can get ahead and you can be anything. You can be the president, you can be the prime minister, you can be a CEO. And increasingly in our systems and in our countries, it seems like that power and that success is limited basically to the children of those who've already been there. And it's not hard to see why that risks a revolt. And you've seen it in recent elections where Bolsonaro in Brazil ran on, I'm going to return the meritocracy to the real people, and kind of ran against gender quotas. Giorgia Meloni in Italy did the same thing. She said, well, these quotas for women in boardrooms or women in government have disrupted the real meritocracy and have prevented people from getting the jobs for which they're actually qualified. President Yoon Suk-yeol in South Korea did something very similar. And it's not hard to see why these populists are tapping into that, because they're basically just telling young disillusioned people, mainly young disillusioned men, that you're not succeeding and you're not getting ahead because the system is broken, because the meritocracy is broken. And the diagnosis is not necessarily wrong, but blaming, you know, women or women's participation in the labor force for messing up meritocracy is very obviously not the problem. The problem is the same people who promise to fix meritocracy be based on kind of ethnic or gender quotas, saying those are the problem, often come in and elevate the same kind of swampy people, for to use a kind of American term. So I think that's the real concern, is that the breakdown of meritocracy is going to lead to a reduction of trust in government, I think, or trust in government and trust in the overall system. I think that should be fairly clear.
Absolutely, because when I think about the trickle-down effect, if you're more likely to be put into a government position because you know someone or your father's friend or etc., and then that person ends up being in that position and they're not particularly good at that job, it essentially will have members of the public just thinking, okay, things are all bad because this person's very incompetent. Why are they here? So they still have much less trust within the system, don't they, as a result of it?
Absolutely. And I think one other unintended side effect is when you elevate people into government jobs for which they are not qualified because they know people, you also undermine the civil servants, because the civil servants or the career diplomats will say, well, why is this person getting the ambassadorship to X, Y, or Z country? Like, I've been here 25 years and I'm actually qualified. I actually speak the language, or I've lived there, or whatever. But things are handed out for political reasons. And that's just another problem, where it's not hard to see how elevating unqualified people into government jobs is going to really spurn and frustrate the civil servants, which will, one, either just reduce their performance because they're frustrated and don't feel like they can get ahead, or two, we'll just force them to leave and go look for jobs elsewhere. And those are both real problems, where I know, despite the UK political debate around civil servants, it should be fairly obvious that you do actually really need a very high quality civil service to make your government work very effectively. And Singapore, to its credit, is an example of this, where they have an extremely effective civil service because they pay civil servants a private sector competitive wage. That's kind of point one. And it's really the political appointments thing is very, very different in Singapore, and it's much harder to end up running a department on purely political kind of connections. You can't really get ahead in Singapore. There's no way to cheat. There's no way to cheat on a test or network your way through a test. Whereas the United States or the UK, to get one of these jobs, you rarely need to test for it or anything like that.
You mentioned Singapore, which is a meritocratic society, which essentially also means that there's no levels of cronyism. But also, when we look at governments taking accountability, once again, Singapore has low levels of corruption and more actions are being done to bring to justice unlawful practices within the private sector. So where is it? Have democratic governments fallen behind when it comes to taking accountability, Charles?
I think one of the big problems is democratic governments are very worried about taking any kind of action against former leaders for fear of that being seen as political. So there, I think there's been very little action, obviously, in the United States. I mean, the most famous example is the pardoning of President Nixon, or the fact that as of yet, there have been no charges filed against former President Trump. And I'm not a lawyer, so I'm not going to sit here and say we need to file X, Y, and Z. But it is an example. And then I think the kind of interesting examples to me are like for France and South Korea, which I say always get half the equation right. In France, I forget what the actual charge was, found former President Sarkozy guilty of some relatively minor charge, but for a normal person would have probably carried a year, 2 years in prison. And Sarkozy has not served a day in prison. And on the South Korean side, I guess it's the last four presidents, minus the most recent ex-president Moon Jae-in, but at least four presidents since South Korea became a democratic country have actually been found to have been corrupt either while in office or then after the fact, and have been sentenced to prison time or whatnot. And they've all been pardoned after a certain time. And what's fascinating to me is even President Moon Jae-in, well, basically ran saying, former President Park, who was corrupt, that was so bad, I'm going to run as this clean governance guy, I'm going to fix all of that. And then he eventually pardoned her, basically saying, well, she's sick, she's old, it's kind of a compassionate release. And I understand that, but it does continue to send this message of there are two sets of rules. There are rules for everyone else and then rules for the elite. And the elite can kind of just get away with things. And certainly a few years in prison is not nothing. I mean, it's important. And I think it's important that South Korea does get half the equation right. But I think it sends a really negative message. And there's one really interesting, more positive example is Malaysia, which is a really complicated democracy. I mean, it's a messy democracy, very loud, very boisterous, lots of kind of complicated internal politics. The current government is not so stable. I mean, it's a coalition that's like stable-ish, but not so stable. But to their credit, former Prime Minister Najib Razak was super corrupt. It's kind of a well-understood scandal at this point, and was sentenced to, I think, 10 years in prison. And everyone expected, well, he's close with the king. The king will just pardon him, or his political allies who are part of the current coalition will force the prime minister to try to push the king for a pardon. And that hasn't happened yet. He's still in prison. And that is not what people expected for a developing democracy like Malaysia. And I actually think that is a very helpful and strong signal, not only to democracies in Asia, but to democracies around the world, that yes, we can actually put corrupt politicians in prison when they are very clearly corrupt and have clearly broken the law. And I think there is the continued concern of how do you do that without it looking political. But I think as long as it's being done by a clearly independent judiciary that is not tied to one party or the other, I think it can be a positive message of accountability to send to the general public.
You say in the book that a president like Donald Trump or Viktor Orban in Hungary could never have come to power if people trusted their government. How much has the nature of democratic governments' short-term thinking led to the outcome of citizens not having much trust in their governments, would you say?
I think it's very much connected I'll give you one example in terms of short-term thinking, where for the last 20, 25 years, this is really an issue with US, UK, I think, expanded trade with developing countries that basically said, well, we're going to outsource a lot of our manufacturing to countries like China and Vietnam because it's much cheaper there. It's much cheaper, and the costs or the saved money will be passed down to consumers. Certainly, it's cheaper for Americans and Brits to buy our shoes because our shoes are made in China or Vietnam than if we did it at home, because you'd have to pay Brits and Americans more and the whole thing. So that's a benefit, but the policymaking was quite short term, where there wasn't much of a thought, I don't think, of, well, what are we going to do with the people who are left unemployed, the American and British manufacturers who were making the shoes, or were doing mining, or were doing all these things that we've kind of outsourced to the developing world. And in the US, at least, there is kind of a trade compensation program that tries to give people money whose jobs are displaced by trade. But that is a deeply inefficient system and is not exactly one that is well managed or really up to the task. And there wasn't much of a thought process of, well, if our economy is going to shift from more manufacturing to more consumption-based, or from more manufacturing to more kind of high-tech design, or if we want to move some critical sectors home, like semiconductor production, well, can we train the people who were doing mining to help design or make semiconductors? And there wasn't a long-term thought process, I don't think, and certainly I don't mean to suggest that there weren't some people doing this work. I'm sure they were, but various administrations and, you know, various prime ministers in the United Kingdom, I don't think had serious plans for thinking, what are we going to do with these people who previously earned their livelihood and frankly kind of a sense of respect from working with their hands on a day-to-day basis? And that is one very clear example to me of, well, if people say, I've elected these governments, both right-wing and left-wing, for 20 years, and the same kind of establishment politicians have outsourced my job, have left me unemployed, have left me without kind of anything to do on a day-to-day basis for which I feel like I will earn respect, it's not hard to see why you might vote for something different. And whether that different is someone like Donald Trump, who promises to basically fix the trade deficits with somewhere like Vietnam and bring manufacturing home, even though for a variety of reasons, bringing manufacturing home at that level is a pipe dream in the United States, but he's promising to do it. And saying, I'm going to bring your jobs back. I'm going to stop immigrants taking your jobs. I'm going to stop outsourcing your jobs. And it's not hard for me to understand why someone who feels like their government has let them down for so long would be sympathetic to someone like that.
And you mentioned how in places such as Singapore, UAE, there's like a very high approval rating of the government. And this is mainly because they deliver on their promises, isn't it?
It's mostly because they deliver on their promises. And because those countries, particularly somewhere like Vietnam, Singapore, UAE, were within a generation impoverished. I mean, Vietnam still has pockets of poverty, but the UAE and Singapore were within living memory, like nothing. I mean, they were essentially harbors, their existence justified only by the transport needs of empire. I mean, there wasn't much there. And they had really effective governments that leveraged, whether in Singapore that was the ability to be a financial hub, or the UAE leveraged the kind of oil resources to build really effective governments and to build really effective states and to lift a lot of people out of poverty. And something similar is true in China, even though China does have, you know, significant pockets of poverty throughout the country, but still, I mean, it's billions of people lifted out of poverty, which is not nothing. So that's part one, is there's just performance legitimacy. If people say, my government's performed well enough. I mean, if you're 60 years old, you remember what the UAE was. You remember what China was, and you see what it is today. And that's, I understand why you'd have enough support in the government at that point. And then part two is, of course, authoritarian governments control the media ecosystem. So there are not as many dissenting views, to say the least. I mean, Singapore, UAE, and China are very different in terms of scales of how much the media is controlled. I think Singapore is probably the most kind of quote-unquote open of the three, but the state really controls what information is available. So there is just less negative press of, well, did the government try a project that didn't work and we waste a lot of taxpayers' money? That happens in every country, but there's less reporting on it in authoritarian countries because they've controlled the media space. And that certainly provides something of an artificial boost to trust in government. But I also think it is too easy sometimes for people sitting in democracies in London or the United States to kind of say, well, you know, of course, they only have trust in government because everything is manufactured in the media ecosystem is all fake. It's a little bit of a cop-out because a lot of the trust in government is genuine. Even if the number of, you know, 90% of people trust the Chinese government, even in reality, if that's closer to like 60, that's still higher than almost every Western democracy. The U.S. hovers around 20% and has for the better part of two decades. I think the U.K. is like slightly higher, but now might be slightly lower after the last year. So I think it's a little bit of a cop-out for us to say sometimes, well, it's just because they control the media ecosystem. It certainly plays a substantial role, but there is a lot of trust in the governments because people do feel like the governments have delivered. And even if you were to go to the UAE, Singapore, China today and fully opened the media ecosystem, I think there still would be high levels of trust in government. And it's kind of an uncomfortable truth that people don't want to think about so much as well. These authoritarians, are people actually support them? And it's not the Soviet Union ruling by such aggressive repression. And not that there is not repression in authoritarian countries, obviously there is, but China's government is not in power solely because it's repressive. China's government remains in power and is almost entirely unchallenged today because it delivers. And I would say the same goes for Singapore and the UAE.
How how can democratic governments learn from the private sector when it comes to long-term thinking?
I think private sector companies, to their credit, are something, I can't remember who said it, I'm going to butcher the quote, but it's something to the effect of they're long-term greedy, where they're thinking, well, how am I going to make profits in the long run? Well, the best companies are, not all of them. But if you're thinking, well, how am I going to increase my returns in the next quarter, and you don't have a plan for the quarter beyond that, it doesn't reason to think that your company is going to be so great for the foreseeable future. Whereas the best companies are the ones that are thinking 10 years down the line of, well, what are the geopolitical tensions going to be in 10 years? Or what's the labor force going to look like in 10 years? How can I make sure I'm ready for that? And I think the big discussion now is, well, people are concerned of, are US-China tensions going to worsen? Can I continue relying on Chinese manufacturing? And I think some of the very smart companies are thinking about how to fix that and how to manage that tension. Whereas if you're just focused on the short term, and I think you can see this, the example I use in the book is obviously many of the financial institutions and the banks and whatnot in the lead up to the 2008 crisis were basically just focused on making as much money as they could in the next 6 months, next 12 months, with no real thought beyond, well, what is going to happen if this bubble we've kind of built breaks? But the best companies, definitely more so than most governments, I would argue, are thinking about how they can provide the best returns in the long run, because if they don't, they'll lose their jobs. I mean, if you have a board you have to report to and you're not making money for the board consistently, you're going to lose your job. So you can't just make a ton of money in one quarter and then say, well, we're done, we're good. That's not how it works. So I think the continued drive for prosperity and for success in the private sector is something that's very helpful that I think governments don't have so much. I mean, democratic governments are a little bit different because obviously voters are the boardroom in that sense. Voters are the check on power. But very often, I think we've been in democratic countries kind of bogged down in other issues. I think we get lost in kind of cultural issues and we stop focusing so much on, well, how is each government going to make sure that everyone's life is better? How are we going to make sure I have more money in my pocket and then I'm going to live longer? And I think we've kind of lost that imperative. And of course, if you're a company, that's all you're thinking about is how are there more money? How is there more money in our pockets? How is there more money in our shareholders' pockets? How are we selling more of our products or whatnot? So I think just the profit imperative of being long-term greedy, and in the case of countries, being greedy for your people, could be a positive mantra.
If you was to say to anybody, well, not anybody, let me not say anybody, if you say to a lot of people, immigration could be a tool that is used to help a democracy prevail, they'd think, what are you talking about? But once again, in the book, you made a very, very good point that politicians should focus on things and talk more about things that they're good at rather than be throwing mud on their opposition, essentially. How can immigration actually help democracies prevail? Because there are many positives about it, which many people are very, very much unaware of, because that's not usually where the conversation goes. The conversation, as you mentioned in the book, usually goes around moral grounds, doesn't it?
Sure. And I mean, there is a moral case for immigration, too. I mean, my great-grandfather came to the United States from what was Austria-Hungary, kind of fleeing anti-Semitism. So clearly there is a moral imperative to immigration. But at a time when people are feeling like they don't have as much money in their pockets, when they're feeling stretched, they don't want to hear so much about the moral imperative of people beyond their borders. They want to understand, how is an increase in immigration going to help me? How is it going to help my city? How is it going to help my town? How is it going to help my children down the line? And there are very clear benefits here. And it's a very interesting divergence between the United States and the United Kingdom and even more of Europe, where even when President Trump was in power, and obviously the Trump administration was not particularly pro-immigration, there's a strong American bureaucracy that continued to facilitate immigration. Even if there was stronger efforts on the southern border, there were still an effort to facilitate more high-skilled immigrants to come study in the United States for master's or PhDs or undergrad, and then they can stay for a few years and work for companies like Apple or whatever. And the UK does that a little bit, but the headlines are always so incendiary. The headlines are always about the Channel migrant crossing or the migrants coming across the southern border in the United States and the need to kind of keep them out. And that's the wrong focus here, where there are two examples that are really positive to me, where one, is this city in upstate New York called Utica, which is maybe 5 hours north of New York City. It's like 4 hours south of Canada. It's an old Rust Belt city. It used to be a lot of production. And of course, as the United States shifted manufacturing abroad, the city declined. People left, became poorer, became fairly dangerous. And maybe 20, 30 years ago, a little bit longer than that, the U.S. started really thinking about strategically resettling immigrants there as a way of boosting the city. So they pulled people from mostly Southeast Asia and then kind of the Balkans. So there are a lot of Bosnians, a lot of people from Burma, a lot of people from Vietnam who have come and totally revitalized that city because the city also provided them with jobs training. It said, well, our city's kind of underpopulated in certain respects. We have a labor shortage. Let's train you to become factory workers in a yogurt factory or in a hospital, to become a physician's assistant or something like that. And then in Denmark, parts of Denmark have done the same thing. They basically said, well, we can't choose all of our immigrants. We can't say we only want to take the immigrants who have masters or PhDs who are going to come here and be doctors or are going to come here and design semiconductors or design vaccines. There are refugees who are going to show up who, under international law, have a right to have their asylum claims heard. And if the government decides that that's a legitimate asylum claim, they have the right to stay. So sometimes, and fairly often, those people do not necessarily have the same, what we would consider, high skills, whether that's, they might not be ready to be a doctor or to design semiconductors. But because fertility rates are fairly low across the West, there is going to be, and there already is, a labor shortage even at the lower skilled level. So Denmark spent a lot of government money on training people to fill in some of these jobs, like a bus driver or a bank teller. And in the end, those people were more likely to get employed, stay employed, and thus pay more money back into the system in taxes than they received in assistance in the first place. And study after study shows this, that in the United Kingdom and the United States, and I think even Germany, immigrants pay more into the system than they take out. Immigrants are more likely to innovate than non-immigrants. Immigrants are more likely to open businesses than non-immigrants. And it's not, that connection is not so hard to make either, where if you're willing to drop everything at home, wherever home is, and flee to a completely unknown country, you're willing to take that risk. You're also probably the type of person willing to take the risk that's required to open a new business or to innovate. So I think the examples I use in the book is Google is co-founded by an immigrant. The mini car in Britain was founded by a Greek immigrant. Marks and Spencer's, I think, one of them was an immigrant from Belarus. And of course, the classic example is, I think it's half of the England soccer team is either immigrants or the children of immigrants. The benefits are not hard to see. I just think politicians get too focused on when you're on either, if you're maybe perhaps on the right wing, catering towards anti-immigrant base because it's easier. It's easier to just kind of follow your voters and say, well, my voters don't want immigrants because they're worried about losing their jobs or they're worried about losing their culture. So it's just easier to kind of play to that sentiment. Where on the left, I think people get kind of bogged down a little bit in, I don't want to say groupthink, but in talking in a way that's received by their peers. So if you're sitting in Washington or sitting in New York and you're talking about immigration in terms of justice, that's great. There is certainly justice to immigration, but that's not a message that's going to play beyond that. I think if you're talking to someone who feels like their government has failed them in terms of outsourcing their job, well, you need to explain to them why is accepting more people from around the world good for them? And I think that's a very clear point because, as I mentioned before, no democracy in the OECD, or most of the democracies in the OECD, which is kind of the many of the advanced economies, and no country in the EU, certainly not the United States, not Canada, we are not having enough children to maintain a healthy demographic balance. So the balance that demographers say is needed is 2.1 children per woman, where the US and the EU averages are closer to 1.5, 1.6. Even Denmark, these countries with better safety nets, are at 1.7. Japan is at 1.3, and South Korea is at the worst in the world. South Korea, I think, is now 0.78. And if you have populations that are overwhelmingly old, what will happen is the government will have to decide either to take more tax dollars from the younger people to pay for the older people's social assistance, or instead of taking more taxes, we'll have to divert existing government funds from other priorities, whether that's defense or whether that's social assistance for younger people, whether that's education assistance in terms of scholarships, something will have to give. And that's really bad for the economy regardless. I mean, taking more money from young people to pay for older people, regardless of how that mechanism is managed, will slow growth. And as you can kind of see in the United Kingdom right now, and as you've seen elsewhere, slowing growth and poor economic performance for a sustained period of time is a kind of ripe breeding ground for anti-democratic views of people saying, well, this is not working. We need to try something else. And immigrants can be a huge salve to that of, well, if we're not having enough children to maintain a healthy demographic balance, there is a continued flow of people who would love to live in our countries, who would love to work in our countries, who would love to pay tax dollars to our countries, who would love to boost our economies. And the U.S. kind of, we've decided, even if politicians talk otherwise, and the bureaucracy continues to funnel in immigrants, we've decided that that's what we're going to do. We continue to take a lot of immigrants, even despite kind of incendiary media headlines. I think Europe is maybe 50-50. It's very much country by country, but still kind of lagging a bit there. And I think recent rhetoric in the UK is concerning because it's going to tell people, or it's going to make people think, well, if you're sitting in India and you're thinking, well, maybe I want to immigrate to the United States or the United Kingdom or Germany, and I think you see the current rhetoric coming out of number 10, and you're more likely to not choose the United Kingdom. And that's something from with which the UK will struggle in the long term. And even further down the spectrum of concern, actually, are Japan and South Korea, which for a variety of reasons have worse fertility rates than the entirety of the West and take far fewer immigrants. And that's largely a result of those are homogeneous countries. Most people are ethnically Japanese or ethnically Korean, and there is hesitance to accept more permanent or long-term immigrants partially for that reason, and it's complicated history. So I don't want to sit here and kind of lecture the Japanese or the Koreans, but something's going to have to give at some point. And whether that something is, well, we'll take, you know, you can come and work here for 10 years and then you have to go back. Or you can come and work here for 5 years, you can go back. Or maybe only if you work here 10 to 15 years, then you can stay permanently or something like that. But the current trend of population decline is going to weigh on those countries' economies in a way that is going to only further increase distrust in government. So I don't think either government has really decided on a solution yet. They've both tried over the last year, year and a half to offer more money for parents that have children to kind of increase the financial benefits of having kids. But it's almost too little too late. And they've been trying for years to do it and hasn't worked. So it's hard for me to imagine that these new efforts are going to totally fix the issue. So, you know, even if the cultural debate is problematic, immigration and immigrants are very clearly a solution in the long term.
Lastly, Charles, what is the trickle-down effect of how improving our own governance defeats autocracies?
There are two items here, where one, improved governance at home, very on a basic level, fends off the rise of would-be autocrats, where if people sitting in Wickham or in Tennessee can say, well, I think my government's working fine enough, even if I don't agree with everything, I don't agree with the party in power on everything, my system's working well enough, I'm optimistic about the future, I'm optimistic that my children are going to live a better life than I have, or live a richer life than I have, or live longer. If you're optimistic enough on that front, I think it's enough to reduce the likelihood of someone voting for an illiberal type leader who might come into power and then try to do away with the democratic checks from the inside, as kind of has happened in Hungary. And certainly there are still cultural issues that play a role there. I mean, Orban weaponized immigration. But if you fix the economic issue and if you fix the general pessimism about the system, I think it's less likely that countries will kind of vote for people like that. So that's point one. And point two is making it very clear that democracies work well and can deliver for our people will make it more likely that people around the world once again think of democracies as a model where, you know, I've traveled extensively across Southeast Asia. I was recently in Egypt and you talk to people and say, well, do you want to be like the United States? You want to be like the United Kingdom? You want to be like Germany? They're like, no. In the Middle East, people want to be like the UAE or Saudi Arabia because they feel like there's no political chaos. Everything seems simple, which is a misread for a variety of reasons, but that's the perception. And if you travel around Asia and even parts of democratic Asia, so even Indonesia, which is definitely a democracy, even Malaysia, or even parts of the Philippines, people say, I want to be like Singapore. Look at what Lee Kuan Yew did. Look at how he built this country out of nothing into a strong, successful international player that punches way above its weight, that gets meetings with the U.S. president. I mean, Singapore gets meetings with the U.S. president and the Chinese leader, you know, whenever, every 4 years, every 3 years, if not more than that, which is a pretty remarkable achievement for this kind of tiny little country. So it's not hard for me to understand why people looking at that versus looking at Brexit, or looking at three prime ministers in 3 months, or looking at January 6th, say, well, that's not what we want. And I think it's hard to overstate how much January 6th was damaging, certainly to American democracy. But January 6th, coupled with the rise of the AfD in Germany, coupled with Brexit, coupled with the three prime ministers in 3 months, it feeds this narrative of democracies being inept, or democracies being too chaotic, or if you would ask a Chinese leader, of they might say, of democracies being outdated, of democracy might not being up for kind of the challenge of the 21st century. And obviously, I think that is all wrong, which is why I've written the book to basically say we need to double down on democracy and make democracy fit for its purpose in the 21st century, rather than looking to new types of systems. Because autocracy, there might be a few examples of autocracy working today, but even that quote unquote working is an exchange of people giving away their freedoms in return for economic benefit. That is not a trade I'm willing to make, and I would wager that's not a trade that most democratic citizens are willing to make.
That was Charles Dunst, author of the book Defeating the Dictators, How Democracy Can Prevail in the Age of the Strongman. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to Charles for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.